Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to take a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum, a tax professional from Green Bay. She's been in the tax business for 30-plus years, and she joins us from our WPR studios in Green Bay. And Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Larry.
Oh, it's great to have you back. And you know, 3 months almost to the day, we'll be filing our taxes. We'd better have our taxes filed.
Well, unless you plan on doing an extension, you're exactly right.
What should we be doing right now?
Gathering all of the data, all of the forms, and all of the data that you have at your disposal, like your own itemized deductions that you may not be getting specific forms for, your charitable contributions, your medical expenses, those kinds of things that you have to gather yourself if you're an individual, or doing your end-of-the-year bookkeeping if you happen to be a small business or a large business, for that matter.
Yeah, and does the IRS, do they begin accepting returns right away now, or are they?
Let's see, today is the first day, January 19th is the first day that they are accepting individual returns.
But for many of us, at least if you work, you probably haven't gotten your W-2s yet. At least I haven't.
W-2s and 1099s are required to be to the consumer or the receiver by January 31st. And they have the issuer has a longer time to get them to the IRS. But they are supposed to be in the hands of the consumer by the 31st.
And generally speaking, most people, let's say if you're a member of a church, for example, they may not be required to have that information to you by the end of the month, but I think most of them do.
Most of them do. The end of the month is pretty much the traditional date. Places like your brokerage companies and things like that oftentimes get an extension on getting theirs out, and rarely do you get the brokerage information by the end of January. Many times it's the middle of February and sometimes later. And also your K-1s from partnerships and S-corporations, those tend to come later.
What's new this year? I know there's been a lot of concern about healthcare requirement documentation and so forth, but maybe you could talk about that and what else might be new.
Sure. There aren't a lot of new things this year, but there are things that have been enacted in the past that either have been extended or parts of the healthcare puzzle that are starting to take effect that didn't before. And last year, we did have the requirement to prove that you had health insurance. Except the tough part was for the tax professional, there was no form that was available generally last year that said, I have health insurance and it covers all of these people in my family. This year there is a document, actually one of three documents that people may receive that would tell that you have health insurance. Last year we had a 1095A, which came out to anyone who purchased their health insurance through the insurance exchange. Mm-hmm. They had to have it because the credit for the health care for those that bought it through the exchange was available last year. That 1095A continues to be available this year. The second piece of the puzzle is a 1095B that comes out to almost everybody else that has health insurance through their employer, through their union, through the government, on their own individual policies. All of those people should receive a 1095B. And then there's a third document called the 1095C that is put out only by large employers, those with 50 or more full-time equivalent or full-time employees. The 1095C is a little bit different than the others. It's really the document that the large employers have to put out to prove that they offer health insurance or that they have an exception so that they're not penalized. That one could have some individual information, but only if the large employer is self-insured. Some people will get a 1095 A, a B, and a 1095 C if they work for a large employer that has health insurance through an insurance company. But people should be looking for those documents and bring them with them to their tax appointment if they're using a professional, or have it in case they're asked. Now, there is one other little change to this. These documents were supposed to be out by the January 31st deadline, but the IRS has given them an extension, the providers of those documents.
Okay.
And so when you file your taxes, you may or may not have it. But remember, the IRS will have this document, and they will be able to cross-check if necessary if you say one thing and that isn't the way it is.
Gotcha. Well, Robert in New Berlin has a question for us. Let's go there. Robert, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. Hey, this is a real boon from heaven. Just talking about this last night. We've used TurboTax for the last 10 years.
Okay.
And when you want to redo your taxes from previous years, how do you get your taxes and your tax information back from TurboTax? If somebody's done a wonderful house cleaning job and tossed out boxes that had previous years returned, and you want to recapture information from the cloud, I have no clue.
There should be a place.
That's a tough one. I'd probably go back to TurboTax and just ask them. I know you always get the previous. I think they always have the previous year on file, but I don't know if they go back 5 years. Why am I talking? Mary, what do you think?
I have to tell you that I can't answer that question as far as what TurboTax has. Of course, our software, if it's professional software, we have the information. We are required to keep that information for 3 years for federal purposes and 4 years for state purposes. I don't know whether TurboTax has that information available for that time period, or whether, because you're using their software, the onus is on you to keep that information.
Yeah.
And if you are ever audited, the IRS has the right to go back 3 years to make you prove things. So cleaning your house, short of scanning things, is not a good idea in the tax world.
There you go. So the moral, well, I guess the point is you're going to have to contact TurboTax and just see. And I'm sure if you go online, they have frequently asked questions. There's probably that information for you right on. You may have that information right online. And I'm betting if it does go back, it's probably 3 years would be the maximum. So there you go, Robert. Ann in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Larry. I have a question. For the first time in many years, I received a refund from the state last year for a few hundred dollars. That was from my 2014 taxes. And I received a letter a couple of weeks ago telling me that I have to claim that as income and be taxed on it again for 2015. I don't understand. It was income I've already made and already paid taxes on. Can you explain that to me? I'll hang
sure.
up with my answer up here.
Sure.
It is an age-old question that people are always confused by. I'm not sure what the letter said that says you have to pick it up, but here's the deal. If you itemize your income tax for federal purposes, Schedule A, you generally use your state taxes that were paid during the year as a deduction. When you get a refund, that number that you've used on the Schedule A is inflated after you would subtract the refund. That's why you're picking it up the next year for federal purposes, not for state, but for federal purposes. And so generally, if you have itemized, used a Schedule A, and created a deduction, that state tax will be included in it, that state tax refund. If you don't itemize, you don't pick up the state refund because you've never used it to create a deduction on your federal return.
So there you go. So one way or the other, you're going to pay.
And even though it seems like you're double dipping, they're double dipping, they're not.
They're not. No, they're really not. But I can see why. I mean, I thought about that, too. And I think I asked, I may have asked you on another show, or someone at least had to explain it to me. And then when I thought about it, I realized, yeah, that's exactly right. It's the first time they're taxing us. We have more callers. Actually, we have open lines. We can get you on at 1-800-642-1234 with your tax question. 1-800-642-1234. 1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And emailing, Peter in Madison emailed, he sold some long-held stocks last year that were 10 or more years old, or he's had them probably 10 or more years. He wants to know how the money from that transaction is handled. Are the costs of buying and selling the shares included in the tax calculations?
And the answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
When you sell stock through a broker, oftentimes the sale price that you see is the sale price less the selling costs. When you have purchased stock, if it costs you to purchase the stock, that should be added to the cost basis. Your gain on the sale of the stock is the difference between what you sold it for, considering that sales expense, minus what you purchased it for, again, considering any purchase cost in the cost of the stock. Since it was held long term, there are special capital gain rates that we're able to use. If a person is in the 15% tax bracket or lower, their capital gain rate is zero. If they are in higher than the 15% tax bracket, for the most part, the capital gain rate is at 15%.
Okay. All right.
And it goes up to 20% if you happen to be in the very high tax bracket that usually hits somewhere around $400,000.
That'd be a nice tax bracket to be in.
Sometimes paying taxes is not all bad.
I wouldn't mind being in that tax bracket. That's for sure. All right, good answer to that. Michelle in Arborvitae up next with a question. Hi, Michelle. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Every year, my husband and I, we file married filing jointly, and we have to file a Schedule K-1 for some property that he owns in common with his siblings. Now, we have two children who are about, well, one who's about to enter college next year, one who already is in, and I would like to file the FAFSA early, but I can't do that unless my taxes are done. And every year I nag my husband for the K-1, who maybe does or does not nag his brother for the K-1.
No.
And so what I'm wondering is, can I just go ahead and file without the K-1, and then when I get the K-1, April 14th, file an amended return? Is that legal?
Sure. I would think, isn't it?
Mary? Well, on the FAFSA report, it does ask you, if you're looking for that March 1 deadline date, it does ask you, have you filed your tax return?
Right.
And usually until you have the final, because now they get something from the government to verify that. If in the past we've been able to do it that way, but if you do it that way and then go back and amend your return, you're going to have to go back and do that again and change those numbers. Otherwise, the numbers are not correct. So I really would be careful to do that, depending on where this K-1 is coming from. One of the things that's happening, if it is a partnership, starting next year, partnership returns have an earlier deadline than they have in the past. So they're moving back to March 15th as a deadline for next year. So next year's return might be, if it is a partnership, might be done a little earlier. But that's, you know, short of doing that, I don't know I don't like the idea of filing without all of the information and then going back and redoing it. That's not a good idea, in my opinion.
Better to get after your husband to talk to his brother.
Yeah, I know. And his brother's a wonderful guy, I have to say. But when it comes to this tax stuff, it's all last minute. Okay. All right. Well, that's too bad. But I guess we'll just have to deal with it then.
All right, Michelle. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay. She has been operating that way for 30 years with her husband, David. They operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They're enrolled agents. Great to have her with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Brianne Chasseau, our on-air producer today on the Ideas Net. Right now, visiting with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals about getting ready for tax day. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post an email at talk@WPR.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And let's turn next to Joe in Hudson, Wisconsin. Joe, thanks for joining us. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Question, my son moved out in September of 2015. He's going to college. He probably made about $8,000 for 2015. So he gets a 1099-P, I believe, from the university. So he's been paying rent for September, October, November, December. I guess my question is, would I be better off letting him fill out his own tax form? He's 24 years old. And can he claim the rent on, you know, on his tax form that he paid for those months?
So he should. So you're asking, should he fill out his own taxes,
or should I? I claimed him in 2014 as a dependent on my tax form. So I'm wondering for 15 if it would be better if he did his own, or if I can claim him.
He probably has to do his own, doesn't he, Mary?
He. Well, first of all, the $8,000 is above the standard deduction of $6,300, so he has to file a tax return. But you're dealing with a situation where if he is 24 years old at the end of 2015, he is no longer a qualifying child.
Okay.
And for you to claim him, he would have to fall into the category of a qualified relative, which means that he makes less than the exemption amount of $4,000.
Okay.
So in the situation that you're describing, he is not your dependent for this year if he is 24 at the by December 31st of 2015.
Gotcha.
And at that in that case, he should be filing his own tax return. He should be taking his own education credit, which is what you implied.
Yep.
With the 1098-T. As far as his rent, it depends on if he's renting a regular apartment that pays property taxes or if he's in tax-exempt housing. If he rents a normal apartment that the landlord pays property taxes, he would be able to take the rent credit on the Wisconsin return as well.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Appreciate the call. And, oh, excuse me, by the way, I have a little, I don't know, I'm getting a cold, I guess. My voice is getting down a little bit lower, closer to what Carl Schmidt sounds like, but not nearly as good. Carrie in Sparta, you're next. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. I have a question that relates to the kind of health insurance quagmire that a lot of people are finding themselves in with the Affordable Care Act. I'm self-employed, and so is my husband. We each are part owner of a small business. My small business does pay the premium for my family's health insurance. And we've gotten over the years different answers from different professionals. We have a professional firm that prepares our corporate tax as well as our personal income tax, but then we also have a gal that assists us with our bookkeeping and our reports within our business. I've been told a number of different ways to handle that health insurance premium. This year, the premium went way, way, way up, almost tripled, which isn't uncommon. Now what I'm being told, our payroll lady says, gee, you got to include that with your payroll, and you pay in these large sums of payroll tax, and then you also have to declare it as income. With the dramatic increase in premium, of course, it makes you look like you had this, you know, huge increase in your income when in reality you didn't.
Right.
And I get different answers from different professionals as to what to do with that animal of health insurance premium. And kind of a secondary question, the premium itself is large. It went way, way up, which I know lots of folks are experiencing. But the insurance itself, of course, we have this huge deductible. I mean, it's not really very good. Is there any accounting for that? I mean, it can look like you're earning, $1,000 more a month. It's not really going in your pocket. It's not paying for anything great, but it ultimately makes your income look dramatically larger. And where do you deal with that? And what should you be sending in so that you're covered, but so that you are not paying a payroll tax, I guess, that you almost can't afford?
Wow.
There's a couple of things that you've said, Carrie, that we need to clear up, first of all. You talked about being self-employed and your husband being self-employed. Do you have two separate businesses?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Then you mentioned the word corporate tax.
Yes, and I should clarify. I'm a partner in a little small law firm. My partner and I have an S-Corp. We're two attorneys, and we have a part-time secretary. That's my little small business. And, yes, I would work for the S-Corp, and then my husband has a whole separate business that has nothing to do with practicing law, whole separate one.
Okay. And his is not a corporation. His is a Schedule C self-employed business?
No, his is a non-profit corporation. They're a little bit different. They're a human services-focused agency. They provide assistance to individuals in need in the community. And we have a little tiny law firm.
Okay. There's some contradictory things, but let me address your S corporation law firm. This is nothing new, the adding the payroll taxes to your wages. Back in 1991, there was a notice, 9126, that came out from the government that said anyone who is in a partnership or an S corporation that provides health insurance has to add the cost either as a guaranteed payment as a partner or as W-2 income as an S corporation shareholder. So that's nothing new with ACA. That's been around forever. And so that always should have been added to your W-2 for as long as you were an S-Corp. Partnerships had one other little option with it, but provided you're an S-Corp, it is part of your W-2. It gets added in as wages. It gets subtracted from your earnings of the S-Corp. So the two kind of net each other on the front page. You're picking up what the S-Corporation is not picking up. And then for someone who is an owner of an S-corporation, a more than 2% shareholder, they have been able to take a front-page deduction for that health insurance under the self-employed health insurance deduction line. And so those people, you know, picking it up really isn't increasing the overall income that you come up with. And the self-employed health insurance deduction brought your deduction from the Schedule A to the front page of the tax return. So small businesses in the past have been given a benefit that workers, if they were paying their own with after-tax dollars, didn't get. The change now is that with the Affordable Care Act, the Affordable Care Act has brought for large businesses the requirement to provide health insurance or offer health insurance. But for the small businesses, it has opened up a door that says if they do provide health insurance, they cannot discriminate. And in your case, by the employees that you've talked about, the only people who are full-time are you and your partner or the other S Corporation shareholder, however you term it. Mm-hmm. And if your business has a group insurance plan where the company pays for the insurance, you will continue to do it the same way. You will add it to your W-2 and you will take it off as a deduction on the front page. The other thing that has changed, though, is if that isn't the way that you do it, if you go out and buy your own health insurance and your partner, the other S Corporation shareholder, goes out and buys theirs and the company reimburses you, that's where the change comes into play, because that cannot happen anymore under ACA.
Gotcha.
So if that's the change that has happened, it may be that you don't add it, that it's outside of the business and you don't get that front page deduction. So I'm not sure exactly where you are, but that's what's changed with ACA, is how we do that.
Ah, there we go. Carrie, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call, and good luck. Let's turn to Dylan in Kenosha next. Dylan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. In 2014, I moved down to Florida, and the only thing is I was living at a friend's house, and I was technically living there, per se, and so I was working a server job down in Florida, and I didn't make too much income besides through anything like that. The only thing is I still have to file that tax from 2014, so first off, I'm late on that, but that's a whole different story. But what am I looking at with filing a Florida tax form, but technically living in Wisconsin?
Dylan, let me ask a couple of preliminary questions.
Yeah.
When you moved to Florida, did you give up your Wisconsin residency? In other words, did you become a Florida resident?
No.
Did you change your driver's license, vote down there, do any of those kinds of things?
No.
Did you intend to move back to Wisconsin?
Yes.
Okay. The way Wisconsin looks at it is you are a Wisconsin resident, therefore all of the income earned anywhere in the United States as a Wisconsin resident is due to Wisconsin. So for 214, you should have taken any Wisconsin income, any Florida income, and paid taxes to Wisconsin on that.
Okay.
As far as Florida is concerned, Florida does not have a personal income tax. So there is no requirement to file anything for Florida as far as income tax.
And that's what I was confused about, because I knew their taxing was a little bit different than Wisconsin. So with that, now, because I didn't have an income tax, is it going to be taxed in Wisconsin, even though it wasn't taxed down there? Or how?
Yes.
How is that?
Wisconsin, yeah. Everything that you earned in Wisconsin in 2014 plus anything you earned in Florida in 2014 is reported on your 2014 Wisconsin tax return, and you pay taxes on it. Because you were in Florida, there will be no Wisconsin withholding. So the tax that would have been due on that income that might have been withheld if you earned it in Wisconsin won't be there, and you'll have a balance due more than likely.
There you go. So the 2015, same for the 20 year of 2015.
Are you back here in 2015?
Yeah, I've been employed here since December of 2014. I want to say 2014, and then
Okay.
All the way.
Yeah.
So 2015 is just going to be straight Wisconsin income.
Yeah.
It's 14 that you need to get back to Wisconsin on.
There you go. Good luck, Dylan. Thanks for calling. And Linda and Ladysmith, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Yeah, my question has to do with a message I got from my tax preparer. And it says, due to the late passage of legislation affecting tax preparation, that they may not be able to complete the return in a timely fashion. And I'm just wondering if your guest has any information about that.
Can you tell us what kind of a tax return you have? Are you talking about an individual tax return?
Yeah.
Corporate?
Individual.
Yeah. Well, we own a farm, so a small farm. So
okay.
The passage happened at the end of 2015, but most of our softwares and things have all been updated or will continue to be updated. So I'm not sure what they mean by that. I guess I would give them a call and ask them exactly what they mean by that. Our office, there isn't anything reflective of the change of tax law that is going to prevent us from filing things in the same manner that we have done in the past.
And on time. Yeah.
And on time.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Linda. Thanks. CJ in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. My question, I'm 52 and single with no dependents. I left my job in January, retirement, semi-retirement, so my earnings for 2015 are only about $7,000. I took my 401 from my employer, converted it, and then took about $30,000 into a Roth to keep under the 15% tax bracket. Will it benefit me at all to contribute the $6,500 that I can contribute to my Roth this year? Does it benefit me in taxes at all?
Okay. As far as you've got $7,000 of income in 2014 plus $30,000 of Roth, so your income is going to be $37,000.
Correct.
A Roth contribution is not going to affect that $37,000 if you're
okay.
looking for a way to reduce it.
Correct.
No, that's not going to do anything. It certainly allows you to put more money away into the Roth account, but it's not going to affect your 2015 filing.
Great. That was my question.
Thank you for calling. And Joe in Watertown, hi, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi. I got married in 2014, and so in 15 we filed jointly together for the first time. My wife, prior to our marriage, had a federal tax problems that she still owes on. So we filed injured spouse. And I got my half back from the feds, but I think they forgot to put a code in with Wisconsin. And I did not get anything back from them. And then Wisconsin said they automatically send everything to the feds no matter what, even if it is injured spouse. So my question, I guess, is then if that's the case, can I file jointly with the feds and separately for the state so I can get a return from the state as well?
Yes, you can file jointly for federal and separate for state, but there is a little quirk. Because Wisconsin is a community property state,
mm-hmm.
your Wisconsin return will be half of your income plus half of your wife's income on your tax return.
Okay. So, well,
I would check with Wisconsin to see if you owed, did she owe a Wisconsin income tax as well as a federal?
Nope, only federal. Wisconsin
okay, then,
was all cleared up.
Then what's happening is that the federal is, they sent the refund that you had from Wisconsin to the federal government?
Correct.
Okay. What I would suggest for you is for Wisconsin purposes, you limit your refund. File a joint return, but, you know, do what you're going to do for this year. But for 2016, reduce your withholding so that you just have enough withholding so that there isn't any refund there or minimal that would go to the federal government.
Okay, so reduce that down to, I mean, can you
look at the tax due on between the two of you and make sure your withholding is close to that number. So that at the end of the day, you don't have a refund there, and that would prevent them from taking that money.
So if you're getting, if you're getting $1,200 back, probably $100 a month more taken out. in taxes?
That would be one way. But what Wisconsin is telling you is that when you owe federal tax, Wisconsin or federal puts out a notice that says if anybody has a refund, we get it.
Okay.
Right.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, and it was weird because the federal did send me my half of the taxes for filing injured spouse.
Right, but you filed injured spouse.
Yeah, right. Yep, there we go.
Did you ask the state of Wisconsin if they have any program like that that would allow the two of you, you know, for you to claim your or get your half?
Yeah, I did ask, and they said they don't do that, and they no matter what, if we file jointly, we'll send it all to the feds.
Hmm. Okay. Huh.
There you go. Joe, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And I think you got some good advice there from Mary. In fact, everybody's been getting good advice from Mary. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Wonderful to have her along today. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your taxes with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay. And she and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And we believe we have a link to their site on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Jenny in Deerfield has a question, so let's go there. Jenny, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have, like, three mini questions.
Okay.
My first question is that in 2015, on August 22nd, I got married. And I am just wondering if there's any reason why we would file married but separate, and if I need to file with my maiden name or my current name now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's address that question first of all. Most often people who are married file a joint return. The reason they may not want to file a joint return would be something like the situation that occurred the caller before, where there is tax debt in existence by the spouse that you married. Someone may not want to file for that reason. It may also be that you keep your finances separately and that's the way that you want it to be. Tax-wise, generally, there are not benefits to filing married separate, especially if you have children or if you're trying to claim education credits, because some of those things cannot be claimed on a married separate return. So before you file married separate, be sure that you've looked into that situation. As far as what name you use when you file your tax return, it is the name that is on your Social Security card that will be cross-checked when you file the tax return. So if you have not changed your Social Security card, then that's the name that should appear on the tax return. If you changed your Social Security card and took your spouse's name, then that's the name you file with.
Okay. And then, my one other question was, I work for a woman who has a small business, and last year, 2015, I made about $1,200, but she does not, we get a different tax form because she doesn't have, it's not payroll, so she doesn't have someone taking taxes out already.
And you have a 1099 miscellaneous.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering if there's any way to sort of gauge how much will be taken out when I file.
If $1,200 is your income, you have to add that to your spouse's income, and that will help you know what tax bracket you're in.
Oh, okay.
But there is one other thing. As a 1099 miscellaneous filer, what you're saying is that you're self-employed. And so in addition to the income tax, your $1,200 minus any expenses related to earning that $1,200 is subject to self-employment tax. Self-employment tax is roughly 15.3% that you're going to pay in addition to it. Now, there is another little formula that goes with it that gives you a deduction on the front page, and so it, you know, kind of works out, works a little less than that. But if you multiply that by 15.3%, you'll know what the self-employment tax portion of it is. And then the income tax will be the rate that you get when you add it to your spouse's income.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Josh in Wautoma, on to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
I'm a first-time father, and I was wondering what I could expect back from my child care credits and things of that sort. I've never done this before.
Are you married, Josh?
No, I'm not.
Okay. And you have a right to claim the child on your tax return?
Yes.
Does the child live with you for more than half of the year or more than half of the child's life?
Yes, he does.
Okay. What you will get is a $4,000 exemption, personal exemption, and that times your tax rate will tell you what you get from that. There is a child tax credit, potentially $1,000. Again, all of these things depend on what your income is. The child tax credit is not a refundable tax credit. You have to have income tax due for a portion of it, and there is a part of it that could be a refundable tax credit. But if you have a reasonable income, you're probably going to get the full $1,000 tax credit.
Well, I'm looking at my last pay stub from last year, and my total income for the last year, 2015, was about $32,000.
Okay. And I'm assuming you're single, or you could be head of household if the child lived with you for more than half the year.
Yes, then I'm going to be filing single and head of household.
You'll file head of household. With that being said, you probably will get the $1,000 tax credit, and you would probably be in about the 15% tax bracket. So the $4,000 times 15% will be about $600. And then there is a potential, is there child care that you pay as well while you work that the child is cared for somewhere else?
No. Yes and no. I barter labor with my family.
Okay.
So you're not paying a daycare center
or someone. Okay. So there wouldn't be a child care credit. So you're going to get an exemption amount. You're going to get a child tax credit. And depending on where your income falls, you may also get an earned income credit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Under some circumstances, under some circumstances in a divorce, the one party gets to be the child tax credit, the other person gets to be head of household, and then it reverses from one year to the next?
That's something. Head of household requires that the child live with you for more than half the year. If parents are divorced, they don't live together, but the non-custodial, the person that the child does not live with, can claim the child if the custodial parent, and in this case, the one that's claiming head of household, signs a Form 8332 that waives that person's right to claim the child. So if they are amicable, or if the divorce decree warrants it, it may be that the person the child lives with for more than half the year gets a tax benefit of head of household and also child care credit, if that would be the case. And the person who the parent, the custodial parent, waived the right to gets to claim the exemption and the child tax credit.
Gotcha.
And sometimes people play the game that says, child lives with me for this year for more than half the year. Next year, child lives with the other parent for more than half the year. And the IRS determines who the custodial parent is by the parent who has the child in their custody for more than half the nights in the year.
Ah, okay. Well, I hope that answers John's question. I think it does. Scott in Prairie du Chien, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about inheritance. I received an inheritance in 2015, and I want to know if I need to claim that on my taxes.
Tell me, John, what form that inheritance came in.
Was it money?
It was the money, yes.
Okay, you just got cash. The estate settled, and there was X amount of cash, and you got your share of it.
That's correct.
Okay. It was not a pension that was cashed in, like a 401k or an IRA. Okay.
No.
If it is just cash that you got out of the estate, generally you're going to have nothing taxable. However, if the estate earns some money during the year, not that money, but on earnings, stock dividends, things like that, you could potentially get a share of that as income. And that's generally small in comparison to what you got for inheritance. So the inheritance itself is not taxable. The earnings on any money after the person died that the estate may be holding on to and distributing to you could be taxable.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Jan in Mosinee, on to you now. Thanks for calling, Jan.
Okay, yes, good morning. My mother passed away in January of the year 15, and she only lived, she passed away on the 7th and was in the hospital the 6th and the 7th. Now, does she have to claim taxes for those few days of that year?
Okay.
The answer to this is, if she had any income that she earned from January 1st to January 7th, is income for that year.
Okay.
If it is high enough that she is required to file a tax return, she would have to pay taxes on it. For instance, if on January 2nd she sold lots of stock and had a profit on the stock, she may have to pay taxes in that. Generally, someone that dies that early in the year doesn't have a tax liability, but
no,
they could.
Nothing was sold in those days, no. Then can she still collect the Social Security for those few days?
I believe the Social Security would be prorated, and I'm not a Social Security expert. I know that if you get Social Security check after a person dies, that's required to be returned. It depends on, when in the month she's getting the Social Security check, whether she'll get anything for those days or not.
Yeah. Usually it always arrived on the first of the month.
Yeah.
In Wisconsin.
Yeah. And they may require her to send back all or part of that. I'm not exactly sure of how Social Security works in that case.
Could give a call to the office and probably get a pretty quick answer from Social Security Administration. Maybe somebody from Social Security is listening in and will call and let us know, because that's a more specialized question. Jan, thank you so much for calling. And Eric in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. A previous caller said that that he had worked and lived in Florida, and even though he did that, his income was considered Wisconsin taxable on, through Wisconsin.
Yeah.
My son is a professional wrestler. He works for the WWE, travels all over the country. He has to file taxes in every state he works in. Why would that be?
The reason that Florida does not require it is because Florida does not have an income tax. Any state that has an income tax can tax people who perform services in their state. It's called non-residency. And you may pay taxes. If you're a Wisconsin resident, you pay Wisconsin tax on your worldwide income. If you happen to earn that while you're a Wisconsin resident, if you happen to earn like this wrestling or football players, baseball players, basketball players, any of those kind of, or entertainers who perform in another state, if their earnings in that state are high enough, that state will require them to file a tax return in that state. The good thing about Wisconsin is that Wisconsin gives a tax credit for income taxes paid to another state. So, yes, he probably has to pay taxes in a lot of states. If the state does not have an income tax like Florida, and there are about six other states that do not have individual income tax, then you don't have to worry about that state.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have lots of questions here, Mary, from people, and we're going to take a little break. But tell you what, Mary's going to be staying with us right up until 12:30 today to answer your questions. And so I hope you'll join in. You can always email us at talk@wpr.org. You can go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And while you're there, click like while you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics and, you know, other useful bits of information. And call. We have open lines. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Back with Mary after the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here as we take a look at your taxes with Mary Mellum, tax professional. She and her husband, David, from the Green Bay, Wisconsin, own and operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They're enrolled agents. I believe we have a link to their site on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you want to go there, certainly we're happy to have you go there. And happy to have you join in with your questions. And Marilyn in Milwaukee has a question, so let's go right to her. Marilyn, hi.
Hi, Larry. I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener, and I appreciate your show.
Thank you.
My question is for Mary, and I don't think she'll be able to answer it. I have gone to the IRS. I have called. I have called the ACA. I'm one of those people that signed up for Obamacare in 2014. Mm-hmm. When I talked to them on the phone and gave them all my income information, and sent them paperwork, they said I qualified, so I was very excited because my premiums on my health insurance had gone up so much. I only needed it for 4 months when I started Medicare in May of that year. I was very surprised to receive a 1095A form from the government at the beginning of 2015 that I owed over $1,600. And I'm wondering if I can claim this on my taxes for this year.
Okay. Let's get back to the 1095A is the form that shows how much your insurance was and how much of a subsidy you received.
Correct.
Are you saying that when you filed your income tax return, the result of this was that you had to pay back the subsidy or some portion of it?
Yes.
The reason that that would be is that when your income was reported for 2015 or for 2014,
correct,
it resulted in either being over the top of the income level or having more income than what was reported when you first signed up. On your tax return for 2014, the amount that you paid that you used for the credit that you had to pay back would have increased your deduction for your health insurance because it wouldn't, you know, it would have turned that around. But there is no deduction for the federal tax that you had to pay back. It would have, like I say, if you had health insurance premiums that you weren't able to deduct because you got a credit for that, that credit would have turned around and said I had to pay that, but that would have affected 214, not 215.
Okay. All right. So I'm on the hook.
There is nothing that will affect your 15 return relating to that tax you paid in 214, on the 214 return paid in 15.
Okay, thank you. You're the only person I could go to that could answer this. The IRS couldn't.
There you go. Well, somebody else wondered, you know, I don't even want to sign up for health care. What happens to me if I don't sign up?
This year, if you do not have health care and you do not have an exception, the penalty is $325 per person, or it's the greater of $325 or 2% of your adjusted gross income.
Ouch.
It's called modified adjusted gross income, because their tax-exempt interest is added to it, as well as foreign earned income exclusion, which most people, you know, that doesn't affect most people.
Right.
And keep in mind that in this situation, if you are a family, you are responsible penalty-wise for everyone who shows up on the front page of your tax return. There is a maximum of 300% of the flat dollar penalty, or $975, as the flat dollar portion. If you have more than two children, you're married and you have more than two children, then your penalty for flat dollar could be more than $975, but it's maxed at that. But what catches people oftentimes is not the max flat credit, but the 2% of your adjusted, modified adjusted gross income.
Yeah. Steve in Sparta has a question. Let's go there. Steve, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. See, my situation is I'm 64 years old, and our daughter is going to college, and we have a 529 for her. And I was thinking I was going to have to take money out of my 401 to help her with her schooling. I know I'm going to have to pay taxes on when I take it out of my 401, but if I put it into the 529, thinking about $8,000, would there be a tax advantage for me when I file my taxes in 2016?
Okay. Taking money out of your 401k results in taxable income, but because of your age, there's no 10% penalty on it. If you contribute to the 529 plan, on your state return, you get a deduction up to $3,000 indexed for inflation. It's about $3,100 this year that you could put into the 529 plan and take a deduction on the tax return. So that would be the tax benefit of putting it in, but it would only benefit the Wisconsin return. In the 529 plan, I assume you've been putting into that over the years?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wisconsin has done some changes with their 529 plan in the fact that they're allowing people to roll things that weren't Wisconsin plans into Wisconsin plans and creating deductions. But they have also tightened things in the sense that if you are creating a 529 plan this year and you put the money in and take it out in the same year, you don't get a deduction for it. If you already have one, you'd be taking out the older money even if you put money into it. So I was just making sure that you weren't creating it and taking out the money.
No, it's already established, so there would be some benefit to me.
There would be benefit to you to put that in. Is there a reason why you're not taking the money out of the 529 plan rather than taking it out of your 401k?
Well, it's getting a little low, and I'm going to have to refresh it.
Ah, okay. So you're trying to stretch the dollars.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so...
All right. Steve, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And probably a lot of people are thinking about that right now, given how the market has gone recently. The 529s have, at least mine, lost, for my daughter, lost a whack of money here. Man, you wonder. Bill in Mount Horeb, your question.
Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for your excellent cast effort. Very clear and helpful comments. Two things. The first thing, really quickly, I thought of the Social Security question last hour. My brother's a Social Security administrator, and when our dear father passed away a couple of years ago, he managed to rally and it to the second of a month. And afterwards, my brother said that was my dad's way of making sure he got another month's worth of Social Security. I'm not sure how that worked out. He would know the answer, but he's not interested. My question is this. What tax advantages, both to the holder and then to the potential heirs, would there be for some elderly couple, if they get into their upper 80s and even 90s, in holding substantial amounts, that's hundreds of thousands in traditional Roth IRAs, even into their 90s, what would be their tax advantages, just briefly, with a modest old-fashioned pension and a modest Social Security? And then what advantages or disadvantages would there be to the potential heirs to inherit, $400,000 worth of IRAs, traditional IRAs, even more, if they were hoping to, use some of the funds for various purposes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me make sure that I understand the question. You're looking for the advantages to the heirs of a Roth IRA versus a traditional IRA.
Correct.
And
okay. I'm wondering what the advantages for the elderly person still have such a situation.
Well, if the elderly people have that kind of money, I'm assuming that they're paying taxes even in their older age. Okay. The Roth IRA is the type of investment that you don't get a deduction when you put the money in, but it grows tax-free so that when you take the money out, there is no tax consequences. That benefit passes along to the heirs as well. So as long as it has been, the Roth account either has been created at least 5 years before the heirs receive it, or if it is converted money, that money has been converted for a period of at least 5 years before they receive the money, then there is no tax consequences to the heirs. That's because the people who had it in the Roth account paid the taxes on the Roth money already. The traditional IRA is kind of the opposite of that. When the people who have a right to put money into a traditional IRA put the money in, chances are they get a tax deduction for the traditional IRA. When the people who inherit it get it, they will pay taxes on it in the same manner as the people who they got it from, inherited, would have if they had taken money out of the account during their lifetime. So if you are, for instance, many people when they're older are living on less money than they did when they were working, and they may have an opportunity to convert some of their traditional IRAs into Roth, which means that they pay taxes on the converted amount, and if they're in a lower tax bracket than they were when they were working, it can save some money so that their heirs get that money tax-free. Otherwise, traditional IRAs or any pension fund for that matter that are inherited generally are a taxable type of inheritance.
There we go. All right.
Could I follow up just very briefly? What would be the current tax reason for someone to hang on if you were 89 years old with a traditional IRA?
I'm not sure I understand your question. What would be the tax rate of the IRA if they...
The tax advantage. What would be their tax advantage to not convert to a Roth?
Oh.
What would be the tax advantage of not converting to the Roth? If they have IRA money, and what you're dealing with, first of all, for someone who is over the age of 70 and a half... A traditional IRA requires you to take out a minimum amount each year, depending on the size of the IRA. That amount is required to be taken out, and it will be taxed at whatever rate these people are at. If they convert to a Roth, the Roth does not require them to take any money out at age 70 and a half. It's a play between, do I want to pay taxes on the money now, given my tax rate, or do I want and pass along non-taxable income to my heirs? Or do I want to keep my money now and let the heirs pay taxes on it when they get it? That's kind of the question.
Mm-hmm. And for those 70 and a half, if they are working full-time, they're not required to withdraw, are they?
That's a question that people get wrong in a sense. You're right in saying that there is an exception if you continue to work and you are not a more than 5% owner of the company that you're working for. The money that is in your pension fund, IRA, 401k, defined pension, you know, whatever, that money does not have to come out until you retire. But your IRA money, the traditional IRA that you have accumulated or rolled over from a previous pension, that money is subject to the minimum required distributions, regardless of whether you're working or not.
And Bill, again, thank you so much for calling. Gail in Burlington up next with a question. Let's go there. Gail, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, thank you. I was divorced in 2015, and I'm curious. I know I have to change my W-4s. I forgot to do that. I have two kids in college, but they're adults. So do I make it just single or single on one? Or how do you handle a W-4 now?
Okay. First of all, you said you were divorced in 2015?
Yes.
Okay. So you judge your filing status on the last day of the year. And you are either single, or if the kids are under the age of 24 and full-time students and live with you, you may be able to claim head of household.
Okay.
But when you file your W-4, the idea is that you want to make sure that you have money paid in.
Yes.
And on your W-4, you have three choices. You have a choice of being married. You have a choice of being single, first of all. You have a choice of being married or married withholding at a higher single rate. The only one for you is the single rate.
Okay. All right. So I just wanted to make sure I didn't get caught at the end of this year in a bind.
No.
you could, because you may not have had enough withheld in 2015 based on being single at the end of the year.
But it's
because you were married part of the year and your withholding might have been at the married rate, which is generally a lower rate of withholding than a single rate. So for 2015, when you file your taxes, it might not be as pleasant as you've experienced in the past, or when you change your W-4 to single that you might experience in the future. It all depends on your situation.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Gail, for calling. Appreciate it. And Irvin in Burnett, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question on a single premium, non-qualified annuity, which is over 30 years old. A 4.5% minimum is the interest rate, which is all tax deferred. And now I have my children listed as beneficiaries. But would it be better to cancel them and let the annuity get paid into my estate? Would that create a better tax rate, or should I leave it as is? $50,000 in tax-deferred interest.
How much?
$50,000.
Okay. All right. It all depends on how your estate goes. First of all, the estate, if an estate is not settled in 1 year and the estate has the money and doesn't distribute it to the heirs, the estate pays a tax rate at a higher level or sooner. They use the same rates as the individual, but it gets to that faster rate. So leaving in the estate is not necessarily a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Your children will pay taxes on it if they inherit it. Whether they inherit it through the estate or as heirs, they will pay taxes on it when it's distributed at their own personal tax rate.
Well, see, that's part of the problem because several of them have very, very high incomes and are paying a very high tax rate now. So what would the tax rate be on the estate tax?
I believe it is at $12,000, it becomes 25%. So that would be well over that dollar amount. Let me see. Estate, for 2015, if you had no deductions, actually, if you had no deductions, anything over $12,000 is taxed at 39.6. So the $12,000 is where it hits its highest rate, not 25%.
There we go. Good luck.
So chances are your children have to have really high incomes to be in the 39.6% rate.
Really high. Yeah. Thanks, Irvin. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Matthew emailed. He's a first-time home buyer, bought a duplex in 2015. Wonders if he should get professional advice about whether to depreciate the home on his taxes. Also, can you offer any advice about dealing with rental income and rental upgrade expenses?
Okay. Being in this business, it is always my suggestion that you seek professional help. I know people do them on their own, and some people do a very good job, but when you are changing things in your life that require it, it's good to at least get a look at it once. If he bought a duplex, I'm assuming the second half of the duplex is rental, and that is a depreciable item. Your own home portion that you're using for personal use is not depreciable. You have the normal property taxes and mortgage interest that are deductible on Schedule A if you can use that. The rental income requires a separate schedule that you report the income and you take the expenses associated with that part of the duplex. So I would strongly suggest, at least for the first year, that he have get some professional advice to have it set up properly.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Guess what? It's quite different from what it's quite different from what he had before, and it's always good to get a professional in there to kind of get things straight. And Mary, you're a professional, that's for sure. Thank you so much. In 30 seconds, one last tax tip for us.
I just want to clear up something in this 30 seconds. Joe from Watertown that talked about the injured spouse.
Yep.
Wisconsin does have an injured spouse program. So there is a special conditions box on the front page of the Wisconsin return. There is a code 5 that goes in it, and Wisconsin should look at it in that light. So I just wanted to make sure that Joe knew that.
And Mary, you'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
I will be happy to.
All right. She does a wonderful job, doesn't she? Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, owner with her husband David of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They're enrolled agents, and she does a great job. And so pleased to have her, and hopefully in about a month we'll have her back and we'll do this all over again. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.